The following talk is from St. Michael's Fulwell, a gospel-centered community for Fulwell, Teddington, and beyond. Our passion is to see every life following Jesus. For more information, visit our website, stmichaelsfulwell.co.uk.
And if you've got a Bible nearby, grab it and turn to our reading, which is in Luke chapter 6. Louise is very kindly going to read that for us, and then Sandy's going to come and preach.
So starting at verse 37 on page 1034. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. He also told them this parable. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into a pit? The student is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like their teacher. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take the speck out of your eye," when you yourself fail to see the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take out the plank of your eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of.
Thank you very much, Louise. Good morning, everyone. There are some handouts at the end of the rows, so do grab one of those and do please keep that passage open. We're continuing our series in Luke, and this talk has been given a title, which you'll see on the handout. It was given the title by Ed, our vicar, and it comes from the last sentence of the passage, out of the heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. That's actually a change from the previous edition of the NIV, which had from the overflow of his heart, the mouth speaks. What our heart is overflowing with and full of will come out of it. We can't hide it, no matter how much we might want to. And the heart in the Bible is who we really are. The control center of our personality. The place where the decisions that really matter are taken. The place of our deepest instincts, inclinations, insights, and attitudes. Our deepest instincts, inclinations, insights, and attitudes. In all of Jesus' teaching, the heart is what really matters. Not the visible stuff on the outside which we can fake, but what is going on at the core of our being that only God can see. Who we really are, not who we pretend to be, to others and to ourselves. This section of Luke is known as the Sermon on the Plain, and it's Luke's equivalent of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. Starts with Luke's versions of the Beatitudes, and almost everything in Luke is also in Matthew. But Luke's version is much shorter. It's only about a third of the length of the Sermon on the Mount. And in these two sermons early in the Gospels, Jesus sets out the strange and unique nature of Christian ethics. Has it ever struck you how unlike all other religious and ethical teaching Jesus' words are? It's not a bunch of carefully crafted, realistic rules for living. It asks things way above any reasonable ethical standard. Be perfect, says Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. What? Perfect? Are you kidding? Look here at verse 27. Love your enemies. Verse 28, bless those who curse you. Verse 29, if someone slaps you, turn the other cheek. Verse 30, give away your shirt and don't ask for it back. That is not a realistic way to live by the world's standards. It seems to come from another place. The Beatitudes are a complete reversal of common sense. Blessed are the poor, the hungry, those who weep, and those who are hated. Woe to you if you're rich, well-fed, laughing, or popular. Where is he getting this stuff from? And more than that, it's not about your actions so much as what is going on in your heart, the inner hidden things that no one can see. It can never be enforced or even assessed by any religious system. Today's passage is another example. Don't judge, don't condemn. That's about your inner invisible heart attitude to others. Just like the Sermon on the Mount's commands about not being angry or lustful or contemptuous. Do your praying and fasting and giving in secret, where no one can see you except God. Make sure it's not obvious to others. It's not the visible, external, enforceable stuff that matters, but the secret, unseen heart stuff that no one knows about, but is who you really are. Anything else, says Jesus, is hypocrisy, acting, pretending. You're a hypocrite, he says in verse 42, if you don't deal with the reality of your secret self, the things that even you don't realize. Virginia Stem Owens was a teacher at Texas A&M University, and she asked her 18-year-old students to write an essay on the Sermon on the Mount, and they wrote things like this. I did not like it. It was hard to read and made me feel I had to be perfect, and no one is. Or, it is extremely strict and allows almost no fun. And the things asked in this sermon are absurd. To look at a woman is adultery. That is the most stupid, extreme, unhuman statement I have ever heard. She said, at this point, I was encouraged. There is something exquisitely innocent about not realizing that you can't call Jesus stupid. This was a genuine reaction, unfiltered by two millennia of cultural haze. And of course, these innocent, ignorant kids were right. This is not a workable religious system. No religious teacher ever taught like this. That's why the Pharisees were always trying to reduce things to manageable rules. Give away a tenth of your mint. Fast 2 days a week. I can do that. And it's exactly what we see in Luke's parable of the Good Samaritan just a few chapters after this. Who is my neighbor? The religious expert asks, just give me a definition and then I know what I have to do. And instead, Jesus tells him a story that shocks him and shows that love is extravagant and boundary-breaking, way beyond anything that is reasonable. You mean I have to sacrificially love a complete stranger who's an ancient enemy of my people? Yes, Jesus would say, that's exactly what I mean. Jesus' kingdom and values seem to come from another place. And we find out where that place is just before today's passage. Look at verse 35. Love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High. Because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. This is what it means to be God's children. The standard is not what human beings think is realistic, but who God is. If you're his children, then you have to be like him. As the Old Testament puts it, be holy because I am holy. And of course, it is how God's Son himself lived. When his enemies slapped him and spat on him and ripped the shirt off his back, he went on loving them. He was merciful just as his Father is merciful. And that is who you must be. Only if you've grasped the crazy, extravagant love that God shows us will you be able to start to live like this. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus uses the word Father 17 times in 3 chapters. Be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Love your enemies that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Don't worry, your Father knows what you need. When you pray, close the door and talk to your Father who is unseen and sees what is done in secret. 17 times the word Father. It's about knowing who your Father is and being his child. In a new family, we live radically differently. When the late Queen Elizabeth and her sister Margaret were small, they had a Scottish governess, Marion Crawford. They called her Crawfy. And she stayed with them right through their childhood from the early 1930s until 1949. And whenever they were being slightly naughty, Crawfy would say to them, "Girls, royal princesses, royal manners." Royal princesses, royal manners. The children of the king live differently. If you're a Christian, you're a member of the royal family. Anyone know what the most common word used to describe Christians in the New Testament is? You may answer this question. What was that? No. I thought you might say saints. That's the second most common. Now, the most common is brethren, which means brothers and sisters. It's gender neutral. And Jesus uses the word four times here in verses 41 and 42. The speck of dust in your brother's eye, say to your brother, "Brother, let me take the speck out of your eye." This is how the royal family live. Good parents don't help their children by laying down a set of rules. Rather, they show them what their values are by the way that they live. Oscar Wilde said, "Children don't do what their parents say, but they always do what their parents do." They always do what their parents do. And when you see what God has done for you and who he is, your heart is changed and you start to live in this strangely loving and generous way. Then you will be children of the Most High because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. This is an aside, but I think it's just worth taking a minute to make. This adoption into a new family with God as our Father and Jesus and other Christians as our brothers and sisters is the real basis for Christian obedience. Christians down the centuries have struggled to answer the question, why should Christians be obedient? The gospel says we're forgiven and accepted not on the basis of what we do, but on the basis of what Jesus has done for us. He set us free from the curse of the law. So why can't we just live any way we like? The answer is not in the doctrine of justification, the law court, because we're declared innocent. We're free. We don't need to do anything more. So why bother to be obedient? Well, the answer is in adoption. As children of the Most High, we live differently. Royal princes and princesses, royal manners. And so our obedience becomes natural. It becomes a joy. It comes out of us like good fruit comes out of a good tree. John Newton put it like this in one of his hymns. "Our pleasure and our duty, though opposite before, once we have seen his beauty, are joined to part no more." So it's a completely different basis for living in the right way. And it empowers us to love others and give ourselves away in a way that nothing else does. And I think that's why Jesus puts in this little section about blind guides. Two contrasting verses, verse 39 and verse 40. Verse 39, he also told them this parable, "Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into a pit?" Now, like many of Jesus' sayings, this is enigmatic. He doesn't explain who the blind teachers are. He leaves us to puzzle over it. In Matthew chapter 15, he uses almost identical words to talk about the Pharisees, but he doesn't specify here who the teachers are. And I think he leaves it open because this is true not just of the Pharisees, but of all human religious teaching. If it's all about human standards, about visible external things, then in the end, it's never going to change you in the only place that matters, which is in your heart, the core of who you are. So in the end, all human religious teaching will lead you into the pit of self-righteousness and destruction. Leave them, Jesus says in Matthew. On the other hand, the next verse, verse 40, the student is not above his teacher, but everyone who's fully trained will be like their teacher. If you follow my teaching, Jesus is saying, you'll end up like me. This version uses fully trained to translate the word. It's used elsewhere in the Gospels for mending fishing nets, restoring them to the way they were originally meant to be. And the Authorized Version translates it as perfect. Everyone that is perfect shall be like his master. This is how human beings were intended to be. Like me, says Jesus, fully restored, as merciful as the Father, as kind to the wicked as he is. This is what human beings were designed to be like. This vision really comes from another place, doesn't it? There's nothing like it. C.S. Lewis writes this in Mere Christianity. Christianity asserts that every individual human being is going to live forever. There are a good many things that would not be worth bothering about if I were only going to live for 70 years, but which I better bother very seriously if I'm going to live forever. Perhaps my bad temper or my jealousy are gradually getting worse, so gradually that the increase in 70 years will not be very noticeable. But it might be absolute hell in a million years. In fact, if Christianity is true, hell is precisely the technical term for what it would be. If we're creatures of eternity, then there's no good messing about with the external stuff. We've got to change the heart. And there's only one person who can do that for us, and we know who that is. So those are our first two points: the strange uniqueness of Christian ethics and being children of the Most High. Now, point three on the handout. Let's think more about verse 37. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. The respected commentator Don Carson says that phrase in Matthew and Luke is the best known thing Jesus says in all the Gospels. I'm not totally convinced of that, but it's certainly very well known. What does he mean? He can't be saying, don't distinguish between right and wrong, good and evil. When you become a Christian, in fact, you become much more aware that there are two ways to live, a right path and a wrong one, a wise way and a foolish way. And everything Jesus says here demonstrates that. Blessings and woes at the beginning. Don't be like sinners who only love their friends. Don't follow blind guides. Don't be a hypocrite. Good trees and bad trees. Wise and foolish builders. There are always two ways to live. So when Jesus says don't judge, he's not saying shrug your shoulders about what's right and wrong. Nothing could be further from his teaching. Now, the rest of verse 37 explains what do not judge means. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. To condemn someone is to write them off, to dismiss them, to say they're no good. God doesn't do that to us, and as children of the Most High, we must not do it to others. Instead, forgive them, like Jesus' parable of the unmerciful servant. If you've been forgiven a great debt, then you must forgive all the other little debts around you. That's what it means to be part of the kingdom. And verse 38 is a very powerful picture of someone having grain poured into the fold in their cloak, which is how people often transported it. Verse 38, give and it will be given to you, a good measure pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Did you notice there are three different ways of expressing God's extravagant generosity there? pressed down, shaken together, and running over. God is astonishingly merciful to us. And anyone who knows their own heart knows that that is true. He gives us way beyond anything we deserve. When Jesus fed the 5,000, they ate all that they could, free food, and there were still 12 large basketfuls left over. So if we're going to be Christ-like, like our Father in heaven, we don't give a grudging minimum. We are extravagantly generous with our forgiveness, our time, our money. That is what it means to be a child of the Most High. Okay, so notice Jesus is saying more here than just don't judge others. He's also saying we can't judge others. Verse 41, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when you fail to see the plank in your own eye? The log or plank in our own eye is so huge that we can't possibly see to judge someone else. We can't see someone else's sins because we're blinded by our own. The image is funny and ridiculous and yet also strangely accurate. Let me try and illustrate that. A few weeks ago when I was starting to think about this talk, England won the Women's Euros. And you might think that was an entirely good news story, at least if you're English. But the next morning, the two main things on my news feed were Spain slam England team and Joey Barton bitter and twisted after vile posts on Euro win. I also wrote down the third thing that was on my screen, which was Clarkson takes savage swipe at James May's presenting on Top Gear. Three very negative stories on this good news day about people attacking and judging others. Now, of course, that's clickbait. If you actually clicked on it, you would discover it was something pretty innocuous. But they use these very negative stories, slam, vile, twisted, savage swipe, to lure us in because they know that we love to read stories that make other people look bad. We love it when a celebrity messes up and when people attack each other. It makes us feel good. We think, well, I would never do that. I'm better than them. The social psychologist Jonathan Haidt concluded from his research that self-righteousness is the normal human condition. Self-righteousness, I'm better than you, is the normal human condition. And negative stories bolster that feeling. They're an armor against self-doubt. Because deep down we know there are all sorts of issues in our own hearts that we don't want to face. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the giant log in your own eye? Well, because I don't want to think about the giant log in my own eye. I'd much rather find something I can condemn in someone else. Another example, I play golf most weeks with my friend John, who I've known for almost 50 years since we started university together. And in case you don't know what golf is, you try and hit a very small ball with a very long stick, very hard. So you play a lot of bad shots. And John and I are almost exactly the same standard. Some weeks I'm better than him, other weeks he's better than me. And of course we're very supportive of each other. We say, great shot. If the ball goes in a bunker, we say, bad luck, old chap. But, well, we don't say that, actually. But, I've been monitoring my heart when John plays a bad shot. Part of my heart leaps up. I think, maybe I am better than him. Maybe I'm not so bad after all. You know, it's an armor against self-doubt. I don't want to feel that. It's not a nice thing. I don't tell him I feel that. I can hide it. But it is in there in my heart. And if that's true about golf, which doesn't matter at all, how much more true is it about everything else, the serious stuff? We're so quick to condemn others. When someone is a bit grumpy, we say, well, they are a really bad-tempered person. But when I'm a bit grumpy, I say, well, I was having a bad day. I was tired. Oh, they provoked me. It wasn't my fault. I'm a good person. I'm not like them. We think the worst of others and the best of ourselves. We judge others by completely different standards from the way we judge ourselves. That is hypocrisy, Jesus says. Do not do it. We cannot judge others objectively. And if you're a child of the kingdom, then you depend every day on forgiveness and mercy. If you judge others, you're really saying, I'm not in the kingdom. And in that case, Jesus says, you will be judged. You won't be forgiven because you're putting yourself outside the kingdom of grace. In the Screwtape Letters, chapter 2, the older devil Screwtape advises his young nephew what to do when your chap goes to church. Don't let him think about his own sins. He says, divert his attention to his neighbor a couple of seats away. What's he doing here? Why is he looking so pleased with himself? You see, as soon as we start to condemn others, we're putting ourselves outside the kingdom. And that's why Screwtape says, get him out of the kingdom by making him feel better than his brother or sister. So don't judge or you will be judged. One of the most important commands that Jesus gives us. Got it? But it's not quite the end of the story. We haven't yet read the second half of verse 43. You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Not judging is not the end of the story. We do have a responsibility to help our brothers and sisters in the Christian family to change for the better. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote this in his book, Life Together. The Christian needs another Christian who speaks God's word to him. Christ in his own heart is weaker than the Christ in the word of his brother. Our capacity for self-justification and self-delusion is so great that we need our brother or sister to speak the truth in love to us. But we can only do that if we first remove the log of self-righteousness from our own hearts by recognizing that we too are sinners. We are desperately in need of God's mercy. We can't judge, but we can help our brother or sister. We have to build each other up, as Johnny demonstrated so brilliantly earlier in the service. Bonhoeffer says this, the basis on which we speak to one another is that each knows he's a sinner, who with all his human dignity is lost and lonely if he's not given help. This gives our brotherly and sisterly speech the freedom and candor that it needs. We speak on the basis of the help we both need. Do we think there is a person in the world who does not need either encouragement or admonition? Admonition just means warning. This is why God has bestowed Christian brotherhood on us. He's put his word into our mouth. He wants it to be spoken through us. That's challenging, isn't it? Much easier to sit in our silos and say, they are none of my business. But this is the wonderful, life-changing dynamic of Christian community. The Christian needs another Christian who speaks God's word to them. Christ in their own heart is weaker than the Christ in the word of his sister or brother. So Christianity is not about pretending or play-acting. It's not about keeping a bunch of rules that other people can see. It's about real heart change. Becoming a true child of the Most High, the one who sees into the most secret place. And it requires integrity all the way through, like good fruit growing naturally from a genuinely good tree. We can't do that on our own. We need our Christian sisters and brothers. It is the most challenging thing you will ever do, but also the most important and rewarding thing that you will ever do. In the end, we can't hide who we really are because the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. So we better get to work grasping more deeply the way that God has shown extravagant mercy to us, so we're radically changed from the inside out. So we're going to sing about God's love, love divine, all loves excelling, the love that changes everything about us.